You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutan, and on the Breakfast Grill this morning is Professor Shui Lan, Dean of the School of Public Policy and Management at Tsinghua University. He's also adjunct professor at Carnegie Mellon University and a non-resident senior fellow at Brookings Institution and a newly appointed member of the United Nations University Council based in Japan. The rise of China as a global player is one of the biggest stories of the decade. China's economic might, its ambitions both on land and sea, its challenges to the existing security arrangements, not least in the region, have called attention to how China is governed domestically. And I think maybe, Professor, we could begin there. We all know of China, or we imagine we know China, as a one-party state led by the Communist Party, and that somehow everything trickles down from this one moment in Chinese society and the state. But is that true? How do we understand governance in China today?
I think that if you think of China, I think, of course, I think China is probably, in terms of leading political forces, the Chinese Communist Party. But I think in terms of daily operations of how policy is made and how policy is implemented, it's more or less the same as in many other countries. I mean, you do have a government comprised of many different ministries and so on. That's sort of, one part of that. And also, we also have a People's Congress. It's sort of similar to the parliament in many other countries, are making laws and so on. And also, we have judiciary system that, provide that part of the government service. So in a way, I think, that's sort of the overarching sort of, system. And of course, the Communist Party is really providing sort of the overall direction of where the country is going and making, critical decisions. So that's, in a short version of the system. Yeah.
Okay. Maybe you could give us a bit of nuance around that. Because of the dominance of the Communist Party, because as I understand it, there aren't elections as such. I mean, the Communist Party could not be voted out tomorrow if there was an election.
That's true, yeah.
How does that change the dynamics between the party and government, the bureaucracy, as it were? Mm-hmm. Even, you talked about the judiciary. How independent are these institutions and how do they relate to each other?
I think you are absolutely right. I think that's indeed, I think China has been making a gradual change over the last 30 plus years. I think, as you probably all know, that before China's reform in 1978, indeed, I think everything sort of more integrated in sort of one big sort of, if you can say, political machine.
78 being the rise of Deng Xiaoping.
Exactly.
The
end of the Cultural Revolution in 1976. And 1978 is when China began to, began its reform and its openness and reform. And so that openness and reform includes not just the economic reform, but also the political reform in how actually to allow the governing system to become more modernized, on par with many other countries, how to let the professional management of the government system. So actually, public policy and management, as a profession, as a discipline, also started in the 1980s.
When I think of Deng Xiaoping, I think of was it the four modernizations? Was that what they called it?
The four modernization actually was proposed earlier in the 70s by then Premier Zhou Enlai. I think it was in 1974. I think.
Yeah. And what was the four modernizations consist of?
Well, I think the four modernization is modernization of industry, modernization of agriculture, modernization of science and technology, and modernization of defense. After the Cultural Revolution, I think when Deng Xiaoping began its reform, I think Deng Xiaoping's idea was that China needs to reform to be open to the world and also to catch up in terms of its development, and to build a sort of so-called well-off society. And that has been sort of, what China has been, you know, trying over the last 30 plus years.
Now, there's a lot of talk about the President Xi Jinping, partly about who is he a child of? Is he a child of Mao Zedong, or, politically speaking, or is he a child of Deng Xiaoping? And, you know, we know, of course, that also he's articulated this idea that today China can dream. It has dreams. It's not just being, you know, it's not just a sweatshop of the world, not just, you know, struggling to get the material wealth. It's now dreaming. Where is China now in terms of what the party thinks about the world, its place in the world? And is it Maoist or is it Dengist, if you like?
I would say it's a Xiist.
Xiist.
Xiist. I think the Xiist is that, first of all, I think that Xi Jinping, of course, is a sort of new Chinese leader, and he has, you know, proposed so-called the China Dream, basically offering it to the, you know, to build, you know, a will of society, which was driven by some core ideas. One that the Chinese economy should be driven by innovation, so it's an innovation-driven economy. The second is that the economic system should be well coordinated, because I think in China it's a huge country, so you have lateral coordination and vertical coordination between the central and local. So there's a lot of issues. So it's a well coordinated development, and the third is it's a green development, and because environmental problem is quite a serious issue, so China is determined to address that. And the fourth one is more of the open. It's an open development. So Chinese economy should be well integrated with the global economy. And finally, it's an inclusive development. So, you know, everybody would have to, you know, benefit from the development process. So that's the kind of vision that's been proposed, and also indeed was being translated into the 13th five-year plan. China, you know, makes a sort of drafted some more of strategic plan for the country every 5 years.
And so does Malaysia, by the way.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. So the latest one is the 13th five-year plan, covering from 2016 to 2020. And that's vision.
But what is the gap between visions and reality? And I know as somebody from, working in public policy, you know that policies can be articulated. Yeah. The real question is implementation, and especially in a country as vast as China.
I think you put it very nicely. I think indeed there's always a wishful thinking, and but also the reality. And of course, that's the critical challenge, is how do you translate the vision into reality? I think I would say out of the five major areas, I think the two most critical challenge, one is on the environment. Over the last 30 plus years, while China was developing very fast, environmental problem has also become quite serious, as being evidenced by the recent smog. Another area I think also quite serious is how to, you know, make a sort of inclusive development. Because I think over the last 30 plus years, while the absolute, you know, GDP growth, and that has been phenomenal, but at the same time, the gap between different groups, between different regions, so inequality has been rising as well. So that's the two, it seems to me, it's probably the most serious challenge that China has to face.
What about the machinery of government, the bureaucracy?
Yeah.
Is it up to the challenge that the president and the party have set? Mm-hmm. Do they have the wherewithal? Are Chinese civil servants recruited from the best universities? Are they paid well? Or are the most talented Chinese going into the private sector, shunning the bureaucracy?
Yeah. Again, you really hit on this critical issue. First of all, I think the Chinese bureaucracy has always been, a cream of the cream over the last, many, many years. I mean, you know, Chinese has this tradition sort of building the bureaucratic system. And over the last 30 plus years, Chinese bureaucratic machine also has, undergone some major reforms. Now, I think that in general, I think the government is trying to, do the reform and trying to become more, lean and mean, and to be more efficient and so on. But also, I think I have to say that being someone who's doing a lot of research on this area. I think the Chinese bureaucracy, particularly in the last few years, particularly after the anti-corruption campaign and so on, some people began to leave the government because they feel the pressure is very high, and also because of the government, they become much more open. And so general public, becoming much more critical of the government behaviors. So I think they feel the pressure, but, they feel that in terms of pay and so on, it's not up to the scale that of their expectations. So indeed, you see some capable people are leaving. But at the same time, there's still a very high aspiration of the young people who wanted to join the government. As you know, in China, if you want to join the government, you have to take the civil service examination. I think the latest one is that there's a record high number of people applying to join the government.
So I think if you're a student of Chinese history, the imperial exam is probably one of the things you
exactly.
think about.
That's one of the things, yeah.
If you could just very quickly tell us, is there a conversation in China today about devolution, of decentralizing decision-making, as Europe went through, Europe in the European Union talking yeah. about subsidiarity, that in yeah. fact the local is the best place to make decisions. Is that a conversation happening in China?
Actually, since the reform, there's always been that, not just discussion, and there's been a lot of sort of policy experiments. Because I think actually a lot of the great ideas in terms of reform and great came from local, in terms of agriculture and many areas. So, but at the same time, China is such a huge country. You wanted to also to, for example, if you want to balance up the regional differences, so you want to maybe have the central to have the capability to transfer funds from one richer areas to the local areas. So you want to have some sort of central. Capabilities. So how do you balance that? So central versus local, that has been a constant, debates and discussion. So you see, swings back to more autonomy to the local and then back to more central. So I think that that's always been there.
On the Breakfast Grill with us this morning is Professor Shui Lan, Dean of the School of Public Policy and Management at Tsinghua University. Next up, we speak about China's future challenges, population, environment, social equality. I'm Sharad Kutin, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, if you just joined us, I'm Sharad Kutin. With me is Professor Shui Lan, Dean of the School of Public Policy and Management at Tsinghua University. I want to begin with this idea. We think of, and we still call China, the People's Republic of China, as yeah. communist China, the communist ideology. Where is it today? Mm-hmm. It was a 20th century dream of radical equality. Mm-hmm. We also had notions of class struggle mm-hmm. and, historical materialism. Where does that play a role in any of policy formulation in China today?
To be honest, I think that having a particular label on the country, I think it's a bit unfair. Because I know the communist Russia, communist China, there's a particular connotation behind it. So I think actually what China is a country that, like many other developing countries, has its, suffered its, the past history, but also wanted to develop and try and find the best way. So I think Chinese way is very different from what you've seen in many other countries, including Russia and its former Soviet Union. The best way to understand China is actually trying to combine many different ways in its own development.
One of the major population policy was the one-child policy. And we know that recently there's been some reversal on it.
Yeah.
China suffering, yeah. Ironically, from an aging population, a thing that suffered by Japan and many other. And it has a great impact on the economy.
Well, I think that scholars have advocated for the change of the policy for quite some time. So people are very happy to see this reversal. Not just because of the economy. Basically, it's now, I think China is at a stage of development. I think that indeed, I think there's a better to leave that decision to individual families. But of course, I think in terms of the policy itself, I think that it's such an important policy that the previous government is very cautious about making the change. But I think people are quite happy to see this government is very decisive and making the change quite quickly.
This is a country of over a billion people.
Yeah.
one imagines, you know, more Chinese in the world, and not just, you know, on that level, just the sheer scale of China, but the, also the issue of jobs. I mean, how do you create jobs for new populations? You know, and it's a problem that India will have, Nigeria, as it hits the billion mark sometime in the future. Yeah. What exactly are policymakers grappling with? What are the trade-offs? Yeah. You talked about giving decision-making back to the families over their own reproductive rights. Mm-hmm. But the impact is so much greater than that.
Yeah, exactly. I think that initially in the 1970s, when the government made the decision of the one-child policy, was exactly concerned about the jobs, about the environment, and about and so on. And I think now, in a way, I think... many analysis have shown that at this current development stage, I think even though the family had their own decisions, probably you will still have a reasonable growth rate. So it's unlikely that China will have a huge dramatic growth. In fact, the initial first step in terms of reversing this policy, the newborns were less than what was expected. So basically, that shows that indeed, when you have a more sort of well-developed stage, people's willingness to have a big family is less as well. But at the same time, what you said is how to make this transition, you know, in terms of this relatively quick aging society without actually being rich. Because many aging society, if you look at it global wide, many countries, they really got quite rich before they got old. In Chinese society, would be that we get old before we get rich. So I think how to make that transition, I think that's a huge challenge. But of course, I think in terms of the transition of the economy, how to create enough jobs for the young people also, I think, is a challenge. And that's why I think the government is also being quite keen of maintaining certain economic growth. And that in order to provide enough jobs for the young people.
When one thinks of China's scale, it's almost like a continent, right?
Yeah.
But movement across this continent, I believe, has restrictions that people can't simply access cities, for instance, or start to work and live in cities. Correct me if I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. The big issue, of course, with China is urbanization and how to govern cities.
Yeah.
And are cities governed by democratic principles? How are they... Maybe you could enlighten us on how...
Yeah, I think, first of all, I think you're right. I think, in a way, in the past, from 1949 to the end of the Cultural Revolution, moving from one place to another is, difficult. I think after the openness and reform, the moving is not a problem. So you see a lot of people from moving from rural to urban area. In fact, I think at the beginning of the reform, so only about 20% of the people live in the urban area. Now, more than 55% of the people are living in the urban area. So there's a huge mobility of people moving from rural to urban area. What really, I think, in the last 30-plus years was that a lot of people lived in the area, but they're not so formally registered within the urban system. I mean, they can live and they can buy a house, no problem. But indeed, there were some certain benefits they will not be able to enjoy. For example, I think if your kids, go to school, then, you will not be able to go to the schools that's funded by the city. And so you may have to, go to sort of migrant-funded schools. So I think that's sort of one example of the without that registration system. So that people have complained a lot, and there was a lot of debate. And I think now, in the last few years, you see most of the cities have already provided the, as long as you have a good job, I mean, in a stable job in the city, then you automatically get the registration, within the system. However, there are a few mega cities like Beijing, Shanghai, they still have a very tight control on the registration system. They have sort of like a point system that, you have to be work in the city for how many years, and you have paid local tax for how many years before you can really get a registration within the city.
Now, when people in China complain, who's listening? And those institutions or people who are listening, are they responsive?
I think actually I would say that it's very responsive. I mean, for example, in terms of one-child policy, in terms of the hukou system, and in, so in fact, I would say that there's in terms of the policy response, I think actually now you see a very direct response. I think the challenge is, though, I think it's how do you create a platform when there are different voices, competing voices? So how do you, then make a decision? One example is that in many cities, China wants to build garbage incinerators. But now the so-called NIMBY situation, okay, it's fine, let's build it, but not in my neighborhood. And that problem has become quite prevalent. So how do you make decision on those issues? Another thing is that we want jobs, but okay, if you build a chemical plant, don't do it. So you have some people who really want the job. Other people say, no, we don't want the chemical plant. So how do you make decision? Yeah.
Well, you know, some people say democracy is the way you make a decision.
I think, of course, there are many forms of democracy. So, and I think ultimately from you know, our point of view is how do you make decisions? Whose voices are being taken care of? Who has the, you know, in terms of decision making, who has the final say? So the real machine of democracy works in a very different way. And so we wanted to make sure that China is moving in a direction that really taking advantage of the lessons learned from other countries, but also build its own characteristic.
What countries do Chinese intellectuals look at when they debate these issues?
Well, I think, of course, they look at the Chinese history first, but also, you know, from the Western countries. You know, a country, for example, in this area, I think Singapore has also served as a good example of, you know, what China could learn from.
Okay, so Singapore is this wonderful example
that
is so limited in its application everywhere because Singapore has no hinterland. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you precisely about this, about the urbanization. But the other side is, is your rural sector being depleted of people? You know, what happens to agriculture? Mm-hmm. What happens to food security in China as a consequence of these demographic shifts?
Well, I think that you hit another key point in China's development. Indeed, as you probably know, I mean, China as a huge country and Chinese, you know, the food security is a critical issue. And so that's why the government policy has always been that, you know, we have to maintain a high level of self-sufficiency in terms of food production. And so over the last 30 plus years, and there's a lot of, you know, both technological change, but also institutional change. So that actually the farmers, they do have a lot of incentives to maintain, you know, high productivity and so on, those agreements.
Last question for you, Professor. The question of debt. There's a lot of talk about the financial architecture of China, debt levels, not just coming from companies, but also private debt. Mm-hmm. Is this an issue that's being debated in China today about the strength of the financial architecture and the problem of debt?
Yeah, I think China still, I think the financial sector reform has always been a major issue, but you know the government has been quite cautious in moving along those those areas. I think debt issue is certainly one thing that I think people have talked a lot about, and also the government is trying to find ways to control that. In the last few years, people were talking about that maybe it's over leveraged, both in terms of local government and private enterprises. And so now I think there's an effort of trying to convert. There are some good assets, in terms of local government debt. There are good assets, and then there are those bad ones, and how to differentiate those. And also for some SOEs, and also how to to manage those in a way that so that will not hurt its overall productive capacity, but at the same time that would try to reduce the risk. That has been the government effort in the last few years.
But thank you so much, Professor, for sharing your thoughts on the debates and conversations that are happening in China today.
Okay, thank you.
I was speaking to Professor Shui Lan, Dean of the School of Public Policy and Management at Tsinghua University. I'm Sharad Kutin, and you've been listening to The Breakfast Grill on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
That episode of BFM Breakfast Grill was brought to you by U-Mobile, where data hearts you.